This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. July 20th marks 50 years since the Apollo 11 moon landings. We've talked a fair bit in recent months about the legacy of the Apollo missions. Now, with the anniversary nearly upon us, we're going to celebrate with a slightly different conversation about the much longer history of lunar research. David Warmflash is an astrobiologist and author of Moon, an Illustrated History. David, welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thank you for having me on the show.
So the book covers 100 milestones in kind of lunar history, defining that broadly. And you start roughly 4.5 billion years ago with the moon's formation, which is kind of a complex place to start, actually, because theories about how the moon formed have been all over the map over the millennia and are still a matter of some debate. Tell us about some of the earliest theories of how the moon formed.
Well, if we really want to go back in time, we can go all the way back to the Greek philosopher Anaxagoras. He had an idea that the moon was a rock from Earth that was flung out from Earth somehow. He had no idea how that could have happened. Mm. And he was the Greek philosopher who realized what were the causes of lunar eclipses and solar eclipses. And to figure that out, he had to know that the moon didn't make its own light. He probably wasn't the first person to realize that. But Anaxagoras was the guy who figured out that if it does reflect the sun's light, then the moon is basically just a rock in space, he said, and the sun is a hot rock. And, you know, really, if you were talking to, let's say, a kindergartner, you wouldn't be so far off to explain it that way.
He was really way ahead of his time.
He really was, although it got him into a little bit of trouble.
Of course.
He said that the moon and the sun were not gods, and that's why they're just objects. They're just rocks. And he was a friend and teacher of Pericles, the great Athenian leader. And you would think, well, wait a minute, if he's a friend of Pericles, this is Athens during the Golden Age, why would they get mad at him for saying that the moon and the sun are not gods? They should have been progressive in that time. But the answer is that there were a lot of people mad at Pericles at the time. He had a lot of political enemies, and Pericles was already doing some things that ultimately would lead Athens into the Peloponnesian War against Sparta. And people were not too happy about that. And in those days, the way that you would go after your political enemies was in the courts. They would use the courts against you. But Pericles was too powerful to be brought down by the courts, so they went after his friends. And his friend was Anaxagoras. Huh. And this resulted in Anaxagoras almost being executed, except that Pericles still held enough sway that he could get his friend out of jail and got him into exile. And then Anaxagoras spent the rest of his life in exile.
That sounds, you know, reminiscent of a story that a lot of us are probably more familiar with, right, which is Galileo, mm-hmm. centuries later, and persecution for his ideas about whether the sun or the earth was at the middle of the solar system and what moved around what. And I realized in thinking about that, that I didn't have a good sense of where the moon had factored into that whole debate. Where did the moon come into that whole conversation?
It comes into the conversation in a couple of ways. First of all, the moon is the first thing on which Galileo used the telescope. He wasn't the first to point the telescope at the moon, but Galileo started improving the telescope, making his own telescopes. He pointed it at the moon and realized that it's just like Earth. It's got mountains and their shadows. And it was really the beginning of the idea that the moon is not this mystical object. Although back in Roman times, there was a Roman, Plutarch, who started to think of the moon in that way, that maybe those dark regions, which earlier, centuries earlier, the Greek philosopher Aristotle had thought, oh, those are contamination because heavens are perfect, but now it's so close to Earth that the humans are making those horrible dark blotches that we see.
We're not just screwing up Earth. We're screwing up the whole solar system.
It went all the way back to Greek times thinking that way, except Aristotle bought into this idea of everything in the sky was perfect and the same kind of things that Plato thought and some of those philosophers in the Italian peninsula like Pythagoras thought that there's this perfection of the universe. But Plutarch had thought, no, it's probably like shadows that you get from mountains just like we get on Earth. And Plutarch would have been more scientific about it, except he also thought that that's where the dead people went after they died. So really, Galileo is the first person to look at the moon as a completely natural body, and that's what got it going. But the moon also comes into play for another reason, and that's we got phases of the moon. And Galileo was looking at the planet Venus. And you can't see this if you don't have a telescope, that Venus was doing the same thing as the moon. But when Galileo pointed his telescope at Venus and watched it over a few months, he realized, oh, it's changing shapes. And the only explanation for that was that Venus must be going around the sun. That didn't mean that Earth was going around the sun, but it was very good circumstantial evidence. The full evidence that proved Earth was moving wouldn't even come until the 19th century.
Really?
Frederick Bessel in the year 1838. Yeah, he finally proved it by demonstrating what's called stellar parallax, which is how the angles and positions of things that you're looking at change as you move. The fact that people in ancient times couldn't see that shifting when they looked at stars and constellations, let's say from January to July, they didn't see any shift. And they thought, well, there's no shifting, so Earth must be stationary unless the stars are just ridiculously far away. And that couldn't be. But there was an ancient Greek who did think that the reason we're not seeing stellar parallax is because the stars are ridiculously far away. And that was Aristarchus, who lived about 100 years after Aristotle.
That's pretty amazing to think that far back, that people had some of the ideas that we've since proved to be true. And one of the themes that you highlight in the book, David Warmflash, is how much the moon has taught us about Earth over time, one of them being just the size of the Earth. You were just talking about, you know, trying to measure and figure out relatively how big is the sun versus the Earth. And at one point we had some of these relative ideas about how big is the Earth relative to the moon and how far away must they be, but only in relative terms. And it was only when Eratosthenes was able to figure out the size of the Earth, which is one of my favorite stories, by the way, in all of science history. He figured out the circumference of the Earth using camel caravans and was actually ridiculously close to the right number.
Yeah, Heather. Could you imagine if someone were to put you on an island and say, look, use a few sticks and make a kind of thing that'll measure the angle and measure the length of a shadow and figure out the distance to the sun and the curvature of the Earth between here and this city over here across the ocean. And from that, make a calculation as to the circumference of the Earth. I would not be able to do it.
It's a good thing that's not my job.
And in fact, by reading all these stories and doing the research for this, it made me kind of realize, and I've heard this from other people who have looked into this history, that how smart these people were. They were geniuses.
And so perhaps appropriate that the geological periods and the craters, those dark spots on the moon, in many cases are named after some of these ancient thinkers, Eratosthenes, Copernicus.
In fact, when it comes to Eratosthenes and Copernicus, we got entire periods of lunar history named for them. The Eratosthenian period of lunar history is named for the quintessential crater that formed in that time period, the Eratosthenes crater.
David Warmflash, as you mentioned, you are an astrobiologist, and we've been talking about how much studying the moon has influenced our understanding of Earth. There's a chapter in your book, Moon and Illustrated History, that deals with the possible links between the moon and the origin of life on Earth. So what's the story there?
Well, we don't know this for sure. We don't even know if the origin of life took place on Earth. It very easily could have been off the Earth, and Earth could have been seeded with life. but it could have happened on Earth. And one of the mechanisms involved in that was likely to be mixing between the seas and the land. And billions of years ago, when it would have happened sometime between 3.7 billion years ago and about 4 billion years ago, the tides would be bigger because the moon was a lot closer. And the moon plays a very big role in the tides. It's not only the moon, but rather than being measured in, say, meters or feet, the tides 3.5 billion years ago would have been measured in kilometers or miles.
Wow.
And so because of that, you would have had a lot more mixing between things in the water and things in the land. So it's possible, it's a hypothesis, that the moon contributed to the origin of life.
Well, and you also write in your book that the moon has always played a large role in stabilizing our climate, which, of course, has contributed to the way that life has evolved here on Earth.
Exactly. And in which case, it's even more certain that the moon played a role in the origin of intelligent life, because although we can have the origin of life, and life is very tenacious, microorganisms and even really small multicellular organisms can survive extreme abrupt shifts in climate. But as for really big, complicated life forms, we're really sensitive. We will die out if we have any kind of major shift in our climate. And Earth wobbles. As we spin, as we're going around the sun, we're spinning. But like a top that's spinning, when it spins, there's also a wobble. The wobble kind of goes between about, say, 22 or 24 degrees approximately.
So I mean, that's kind of big, it seems.
It's kind of big, except that it's because of the moon that it's not a lot bigger. If it were not for the moon, it would be huge. The moon is so big and massive compared with Earth that really it's not a moon. I'm using air quotes. It's really another planet. We live in really a double planetary system, and that gives us the stability.
How does the wobble translate into a climate shift?
Well, so in our seasons, when we go from summer to winter, that's the result of what proportion of the populated areas of a hemisphere encounters the sun's rays more or less directly. And so we're getting more direct rays in the summer in the northern hemisphere, while the opposite is happening in the southern hemisphere. And that changes as we go as the wobble shifts over many thousands of years. So the wobble actually contributes greatly to our climate. Not to underscore the fact that we're contributing to changes in our climate on a much shorter time scale.
David Warmflash, the final chapter in your book, Moon and Illustrated History, is the future. So you span from 4.5 billion years ago to the present day and actually up to 2044. You put an end date on it. And what you're looking at in that chapter is plans to return to the moon, not just U.S. NASA plans, but also the European Space Agency and private companies. What is that timeline for humans going back to the moon look like at this point?
It's not clear whether it will be NASA in the mid-2020s, whether it'll be a private company, although it does seem that China is certainly preparing to go to the moon in the 2030s. So if nobody does it before that, the Chinese will definitely go. They have these long-term plans. And unlike us, they tend to stick to them. We tend to go back and forth. One presidential administration changes, and then we go, this has been happening since the 1970s. We get a president, we'll go back to the moon. And the next president comes in, and they have a new plan. Well, we really want to get to Mars. Let's not get sidetracked going back to the moon. And then someone else will come in and say, no, we need the moon to go to Mars with people. It'll go back and forth. The last time that we really had an administration say, we're going to the moon, we're going by such and such date, and we actually did it, that was President Kennedy.
That's astrobiologist David Warmflash. He's author of Moon, an Illustrated History, released this year in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. David, thank you.
Thank you so much, Heather. Nice being on the show.